The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, we've all heard it a million times. Stocks got really expensive in the post-financial crisis bull market, especially when you look at cyclically adjusted valuation metrics that include corporate earnings over the past decade. But what exactly should we do with that information? We'll get into it with the founder of an investment management firm that focuses on dynamic index investing, and he's done some really interesting research into exactly that topic. But first, Valdana, I need to know, now that the Buffalo Bills are out of it, who you're rooting for on Sunday in the Super Bowl?
Well, I'm rooting for the Bengals because...
The Bengals?
They're like, yeah, of course. Yeah. You have to root for them. Like, they're the underdog, maybe.
I heard a rumor you had a lot of money riding on the Rams, though. Is that true?
I have a whole $20 riding on the Rams. But remember last podcast, we talked about how I'm so bad at predicting who's going to win. And I just go by intuition.
Yeah.
That's why I'm betting on the Rams, because that means that the Bengals will win.
It's you're kind of, and then if they lose, you win $20. You're kind of hedged. It's like a good hedging.
Yeah,
strategy.
I know. I think I win like $100 or so. Yeah, something. Some one of those new, you know, FanDuel, DraftKings type of things that are legal in New York now.
One of those type of things. Okay,
but because I'm betting on LA, it means that the Bengals will win.
Yeah, it's an official app. You're not with a bookie named Lefty somewhere in Brooklyn or something. All right, fair enough. Valdana, I'm super excited for this week's guest. It's just a fascinating career on Wall Street. So let's get into it. I'd love for you to introduce him. What do we know about this guy?
I am too. I'm really happy that he can join us. His name is Victor Hagani. He's the founder and CIO of Elm Wealth, and he is talking to us from Wyoming. So thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you. Great to be on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Victor. This might be our first Wyoming based guest. I don't know if we've had anyone in Jackson Hole. Very, very exciting. But Victor, like I said, what a really fascinating career. I feel like you've sort of lived through some of my favorite finance books. You know, you were at Salomon Brothers in the Liar's Poker years. You went on to long-term capital management during the When Genius Failed era. What a trip. And now with Elm Park Partners, just give us sort of a synopsis of your career. I mean, I feel like you sort of took the long scenic route into index investing, if that's a right way to phrase it. But just give us sort of the brief highlights of your career from Solomon to where you are now.
Sure thing. Yeah, I think that's a good description, a long scenic route. Although, you know, studying finance at university, you know, we're kind of taught that owning the market portfolio is the right reference point to start with. Anyway, I went to the London School of Economics, and after that, I got a job at Salomon Brothers in bond portfolio analysis, the group led by Marty Leibovitz, and I worked for Bob Koprasch. Eventually, I was invited to join a trading group out on the trading floor, John Merriweather's government arbitrage group. I worked there, and when John and some of my partners from the arbitrage desk went to set up LTCM, It was right around when I was getting married. So I got back from my honeymoon and left Solomon and joined LTCM and stayed at LTCM through 1998 and stayed beyond that to both help liquidate all of the positions that the consortium of banks took over and then to help with my partners founding a successor firm that kept some of the positions and tried to continue doing relative value trading in a sort of updated manner. And since about 2000 or 2001, starting at that time, I took a long sabbatical of about 10 years and spent a lot of time with my family, my young three children, and did a lot of thinking and researching and catching up on different things. And then eventually in 2011, I started Elm Wealth, which is a wealth management firm that tries to help people with low-cost, diversified investing. And it was really based on how my own approach to investing had evolved after the Solomon and LTCM years and the beginning of my sabbatical years when I was investing in hedge funds and private equity. And I kind of decided to really get back to basics and to get my family's savings invested in index funds as the main vehicle. And I realized that decision was really the beginning of a number of decisions that needed to get made, that it wasn't enough to just say, I'm going to index. You know, you needed to decide, well, how much equities do I want and how much US and non-US and emerging market and all these different things. And I realized that people needed help with putting their portfolios together, but that it should be very, very low cost. It should be a very low cost product. And so that was really how Elm Wealth started back then, with a bunch of my colleagues being the first clients. And now after 10 years, we have about $1.5 billion of assets and 300 clients that are our investing family. And it's great.
Well, one part I'll throw in there. Elm has my favorite investment company website ever, because not only can you read a lot of good writings from Victor, but it's got a game on there where you flip a coin and the coin has a 60% probability of being heads each time. And you start with $20, you get 10 minutes to flip the coin as many times as you can and bet as much as you want of your balance. Victor, I was up to like 10 grand on that thing by the end of my 10 minutes. I assume you pay out on that, right?
Well, we did pay out on that. Originally that's what we did. We did it for real money with quantitatively trained, mostly young people that were either, in university or in Wall Street firms. And we did give them the $25 to start, and we paid them out real money based on their winnings after a half an hour. And if they got, we had a $250 maximum payout. And so if you got close to that, we would say, you're close to the maximum payout of 250, you might want to bet accordingly, sort of into the end. So we didn't pay anybody 10,000, but we paid a bunch of people $250. And it was an amazing experiment. And it really got us thinking that there's not enough said about investment sizing, right? I mean, that everything that we hear about in the media and so on is about what to invest in, what's going up, what's going down, what's going sideways. But we need to get the investment sizing decision right too. In fact, if you think about those two decisions, if I get the choice of investments wrong, but my investment sizing right, I'm going to be okay. I mean, I'm not going to be happy. I'm going to lose money, but I'm going to be okay. If I get the investment choice right, I choose the right things to invest in, but I get the size wrong, I'm bust. And, in some ways, that's the story of LTCM, because, when we went down 90%+ in 1998, there was a broad feeling that the investments that we had in the portfolio were good investments. And that was borne out over the subsequent few years when most of those investments, bounced back to being good investments. But we had the size wrong. And so even though we had good investments, that when you have the size wrong. So think about the U.S. stock market. I mean, in the last 120 years, the U.S. stock market, has gone up 9% a year, right? So let's say, you know, you're sitting there 120 years ago and you knew that it was going to go up by 9% a year. Well, if you were greedy, you might say, oh my goodness, you know, I want to really get rich. So you might have wanted to own as much of it as you could. Let's say that you were leveraged 3x or something like that. And if you were, and if you kept yourself leveraged at 3x, there were a couple of times when you would have actually gone bust, or I don't know, 3, 3.5x, something, depending on exactly how often you were rebalancing your portfolio. But there was a certain amount of leverage, even though it's like the best investment ever, you would have lost all your money and you would be bust today. But if you invested, you know, the right size in it, you would have whatever, 40,000, you know, is a 40,000x or something from then till now, or 50,000x.
It's a fascinating point. And that the questions at the end of the game were, I think, even trickier. And now I get it. I kind of got it. I thought it was more about risk tolerance, but sort of same sides, two different sides of the same coin, I guess. But I almost busted out on the first flip. I think I bet 20 of my 25 bucks on the first flip. So I almost busted out. But with LTCM, of course, and it's the size in two different ways, the size relative to how big the market was, too, I guess. You know, you guys were sort of the original whale, as they say these days, I guess.
Yeah, I think in some of the positions, you know, that they were positions that people were worried about what the impact would be when and if liquidation was going to happen. That's right. Yep.
And Victor, Mike is right in that your website has so much research on it. So, and I tried to read a bunch of it, so I might be mixing some things up here, but correct me if I'm wrong. I think you wrote a piece for Bloomberg last year, and you said huge gains in things like Tesla. And I just checked because I put 2020 really behind me, and I couldn't remember if 700% was its actual gain for 2020. But you had said that gains like that is sending the wrong message to individual investors. And so I wanted to ask you, and the research that, or the game that Mike just mentioned, I think was also part of that article that you wrote. But so I wanted to ask you about that, and also the sell-off that we're seeing in some of those names now, especially in some of the meme stocks or any of those names that had run up just so much over the last 2 years.
Yes, I mean, the, you know, it's all related to each other. I mean, the coin flip game, you know, really helps us to think about sizing in a, you know, sort of on a blank slate. Because, you know, when you're thinking about how much should I have in the stock market, well, you might say I should have, you know, 30% or 70%. So it's kind of like almost within a range to begin with. But when you've got this coin that you're flipping and you could put all of your money onto one flip, then, you know, it's more of a blank slate with the full opportunity to do well or to hurt yourself based on sizing. The main message of the whole thing is that when you're trying to figure out how much you should bet on something that's good, how much you should invest on something that you believe is good, that the objective is not to make as much money as possible. The objective needs to be to maximize your utility. And I know, you know, this is now taking us into an economics course or whatever, but it's not. I mean, it's just that the more money we have, the less that it's improving our welfare at the margin, right? So there's a curve that would be a concave curve that's, as our wealth goes up, our happiness or our utility is going up, but it's going up more slowly. And this is what makes normal people risk averse, that we're kind of self-regulating. The more that we have of something, the less we want that additional unit of it. And so winning is good. We want to win, but losing is kind of worse than winning. And this is a classical economic idea. It's not from behavioral finance or anything like that. I mean, that is why we are and should be risk averse. And it's an idea, you know, it's been around for hundreds of years. So, you know, so when you see people that are going all in on things that are super risky, it really is hard to make sense of that, you know, based on a typical or a sensible set of preferences with regard to risk aversion. And, you know, the more attractive that something is, the more you should want to have of it, right? So if in the coin flip game, if we had made the coin 70-30 instead of a 60-40 coin, you should have wanted to bet more on each flip than if it were, you know, than if we're 60-40. If the stock market is offering higher expected returns relative to the safe asset that you would be invested in if you weren't invested in the stock market, then you should own more of the stock market. But sometimes people just get a little carried away and are taking on so much risk that the probability that they will lose money gets to be very high, even though their expected gain in monetary terms is very high. But they're doing something which is not, you know, necessarily in their best interest. Of course, we could always say whatever somebody does by definition is in their best interest. But I think that we can sometimes talk to people about a framework and they might look at things differently and change what they think is in their best interest.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Yeah, you know, Victor, I wanted to get back to that, what I talked about in the introduction there, this paper you and your colleagues have out about CAPE, you know, the cyclically adjusted priced earnings, or if you prefer the inverse, the cyclically adjusted earnings yield. You know, all the research shows that, you know, if the PE starts getting higher and higher, your future return expected returns get lower and lower. Your research showed is that trying to allocate along those lines doesn't seem to work on a sort of simplified level, that you sort of a static allocation through all the valuations would have done better. And correct me if I'm bungling the research there, but then you took it a step further to figure out, well, how should we be using cyclically adjusted valuation measures like this? So walk us through that paper and what the main findings are.
We haven't published it yet, but it's forthcoming. We've been getting comments from friends and some academics, and that's what you said is exactly right. That that first of all, CAPE, or it's even nicer, rather than thinking about the price to earnings ratio, it's nicer to think about it as the earnings yield, which is just 1/CAPE. And the earnings yield is a decent, you know, it's not perfect, but it's a decent predictor of the long-term real return after inflation that you should expect to earn from owning a diversified portfolio of equities. And that is the case, you know, that predictive power has been there for the last 120 years in the U.S., and it's also existed in non-U.S. markets. And it just makes logical sense. It's based on the idea that a company, if a company paid out all of its earnings every year to its investors, that it could keep its earnings level with inflation and paying out all of its earnings. If it doesn't pay out all of its earnings and keeps some of them as retained earnings, it can actually grow its earnings faster than inflation, you know. So it just, but the basic model is just saying, well, if it paid out all its earnings, could it keep up with inflation? And, you know, that's the underlying idea and why it seems to be the case. So when we look at the last 120 years, we see, wow, when the earnings yield was around 4%, oh, the next 10 or 20 years, equities delivered about a 4% return over inflation when the PE was, when the earnings yield was 7.5%. You know, on average, you got around a 7.5% real return above inflation from holding equities for a long time. So you would say, that's wonderful. So now all I need to do is just own more equities when they're going to give a higher return, own less equities when they're going to give a lower return, and I'm going to do better than somebody that just does a static allocation of always being, say, 65% in equities and 35% in, say, treasury bills. And you would think that that is what you would find. But when you run the numbers, you don't find that. I mean, you find that over the last 120 years that extra information from the earnings yield didn't help you. And in fact, over the last 20 years, it's been really terrible. It would have had you very underweight equities because the earnings yield has been relatively low. I mean, today, the US earnings yield is in the 98th percentile of bad. And so you would not want to own very many equities today based on that rule. But what's happening is it's missing a critical component. What is it that you should be investing in if you're not investing in equities? Or what should you compare those equities to? Well, you might say, I'm going to compare it to bills because I'm either going to be in bills or I'm going to be in equities. Well, if you're going to do that, then you need to think about what's the expected real return of owning bills. You can't just say, I'm going to own this based on its expected return, or I'm just going to own that without thinking about its expected return. And really, what we should be comparing is more apples to apples, you know, either equities that hopefully will deliver this long-term real return, including a premium for the risk we're taking, or something else that gives us a safe long-term real return. And that thing exists, and it's TIPS. It's U.S. inflation-protected bonds called TIPS, and they've been around since 1997. Unfortunately, they haven't been around for 120 years. If they had been, I'm sure that the research that we've done and the understanding of this would be just second nature to everybody. But TIPS is still a little bit of a weird little corner. You know, like a lot of people haven't even heard of them exactly. Or it's like, oh, are those I bonds that you can buy at the post office? So what we did in our research is we said, well, what if now we did this apples to apples investment program where you were either invested in equities or in TIPS, depending on the spread in expected return between the two. So let's take the earnings yield of equities minus the yield, the real yield on TIPS, and we'll call that the excess expected return on equities or the excess earnings yield. And let's do our allocation according to that, and we'll either be in equities or we'll be in TIPS, depending on how attractive that is. So back in 1999, for instance, amazingly, and partly this is because the U.S. TIPS market was so young, in 1999, TIPS were yielding 4% above inflation. And U.S. equities back then, it was sort of a pretty ebullient time for equities, the earnings yield was around 4%. Why would you want to own equities if their expected long-term return is 4%, but you could buy TIPS and get 4%? Well, there might be some reasons to own a little bit of equities, but you wouldn't want to own a lot. And sure enough, that was a really good decision ex post. But it made sense. It's not a cherry-picking thing. It just makes sense, right? And over the last few years, TIPS have been negative. I mean, which is really weird, et cetera. But, you know, the real interest rate has been negative because inflation has been relatively high and expected to be high compared to what we can get on treasuries. And so even though the earnings yield has been really low, the spread between the earnings yield and TIPS has been pretty high. And so it made sense on that basis to continue to own a healthy amount of equities. And so then you say, well, okay, you know, that's just 1997. That's really a short time. What, 25 years? I mean, that's a really short time. And it's super short when you're thinking about this stuff. So we said, well, what would it look like if we went back to 1900? Well, there's no TIPS. So we said, well, can we try to make believe, you know, figure out what TIPS might have been trading at going back? And so in our research paper, we did that. You know, it's far from perfect. I mean, who knows where they would have traded, but we've made some guesses based on the information that existed at each moment in time going back. And then we ran the analysis all the way back. And, you know, just as from 1997 till today, it was a good way to invest your money, it was also good from 1900 to 1997. So that's really the research paper in a nutshell. And it's really just based on this idea that the high, all else equal, the more you expect to earn relative to your safe asset, the more exposure to take. And it's right back to the whole coin flipping, the whole coin flipping exercise as well.
Dildada, every time Victor said going back 120 years, I was bracing for you to make a joke about
that. You were thinking about your childhood.
That's when I was in high school or something. Yeah. But Victor, if I could bottom line all that, it sounds to me that with real yields still negative, it still makes sense to be sort of, you know, aggressively exposed to stocks. Is it as simple as that?
Yes, I think it is. Yeah. And non-US equities, you know, are offering much higher, have a much higher cyclically adjusted earnings yield than US equities. I mean, that's a really interesting topic worthy of its own long conversation. But so global equities are even more attractive than just US equities. So the whole world combined is even more attractive. And yes, you know, that the excess expected return is pretty nice. You know, it's healthy. I mean, it's really healthy. I mean, getting an extra 5% for taking equity market risk feels okay. You know, I mean, you know, these are imperfect estimates. You know, the earnings yield, the one thing you know that is not going to happen is that you're going to earn 5%. You know, that's not going to happen. You're going to earn 6%, 3%, you know, something. But, you know, that's our expectation. And we have to make our decisions based on you know, the expectations based on the distribution of outcomes, and, you know, that summary statistic is useful in combination with the risk.
So, Victor, obviously, I've been talking to a lot of people about the recent valuation reset that we've had since the start of the year. So I wanted to ask you how you're thinking about the bout of volatility that we've seen, especially when we have some people comparing, you know, making comparisons to 2008 or 2000.
Well, you know, our perspective is to look at the broad market, and, you know, the broad equity market globally and the U.S. Have been more volatile than they had been for much of the second half of 2021 and more volatile than they are, say, on average. But the performance in January, you know, it was a down month for U.S. equities. It was a down month for global equities. And it was a relatively large down month, but it wasn't huge. The real story, the real, you know, amazing stuff that's going on, right, is this rotation that's happening within the equity market, where low price to book stocks have been doing so much better than high price to book stocks or high price to earnings. You know, growth stocks have been underperforming, and particularly like certain sectors of growth stocks have been really underperforming value stocks. And that rotation, you know, has been really dramatic. But we don't have too much that we can say about that because I don't have a great insight into the whole thing, because yes, it's been very dramatic, but, you know, that I find it so much easier to look at the broad market. It reminds me, you know, my dad, I guess this joke is probably in many different cultures, but my dad was Iranian, and he always loved this joke about this character named Mullah Nasruddin. And he was looking around his house, and his wife said, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "You know, I misplaced my wallet." And she said, "Well, where did you lose it?" And he said, "Well, I think I lost it in the barn." And she said, "Well, why are you looking for it here?" And he says, "There's no light in the barn. You know, I got to look for it here. You know, I can't see anything in the barn. It's dark." So, you know, that's how I feel that, you know, when we're trying to think about investing, I want to look where the light is, where I can see a little bit what's going on. I think it's, you know, for me, it's too hard to look at individual stocks. That's a really tough thing. You know, that's a specialist thing to do. And there's lots and lots of capital and people that want to do that and are good at doing that. I want to look at these broad indices where I can have a better idea of long-term expected return. And when it comes to, you know, these different sectors and all of that, it's so difficult to have a view, because it's like these things, anything can happen, you know, within individual companies and within sectors, you know, as well. So it's been really dramatic, but you know, from the broad market, it's been more, you know, a lot more tame. Still pretty painful, but tame.
I want to follow up on that, Victor, because I wanted to ask you about that. You know, people talk about how 2020 was the year where every chart we like to look at was, you know, basically ruined for life. You know, we've never seen GDP contract the way it did and then bounce back the way it did. You know, we've never seen some of these things that we saw during the pandemic and the aftermath. Does that sort of, coming out of a situation like that, does that kind of affect your confidence in this academic approach you have to markets, or does it make you believe in them even more that, you know, history is somehow going to get us, you know, through this sort of unprecedented era that we've been through? You know what I mean? To me, I almost seems like a little bit of being risk averse makes sense in this environment, just because we're coming through such unprecedented times. Does that play in your thinking at all? Just sort of, you know, the year where every chart was ruined by just COVID anomalies?
I think that the tendency to look at what's happened in our near-term history is can lead to insufficient amount of concern and worries about the future. We have come to the edge of the precipice a couple of times in our recent memory. I mean, 2008, 2009, the pandemic. These were points where we came to the precipice and we were about to witness permanent destruction of capital. And then it came back at the last moment, mostly due to government intervention and printing of money and support. And of course, we saw the precipice and went over it, you know, in the 1930s, where we did see that destruction. So, you know, I think that that if anything, you know, 2020 and 2008-9 can kind of give this wrong, to me, can give this wrong message, you know, of buying the dips, of everything's going to be okay. Of even, and this is kind of an interesting thing, you know, that within academia, there's a lot of debate about what they call the excess volatility of equities. It's kind of like the economy and aggregate earnings are not that volatile, are much less volatile than equities are. And so it seems as though what's happening is when equities go down, it's a result of two things. One is that people are more negative on the future of the earnings, you know, that earnings growth and earnings, just the real fundamental cash flows are going to be lower. Fine. That's one thing. But the other thing that tends to happen when the market goes down is like that the discount rate goes up, the expected return is higher. So it's a combination of those things. And so if somehow the market kept the same discount rate, equities would be a lot less volatile. And that's really, you know, that I think we have to be careful about putting too much faith in that, because at the end of the day, markets can and have gone to zero and never come back. So, you know, like the discount rate could get really high, but all of a sudden it's like that market's gone, you know? And so the Russian market, the Chinese market, other markets have really gone, and individual companies, it happens all the time, but even broad markets can go to zero and then they're absorbed there in the academic speak. You know, I guess different people get different messages out of it. Like, you know, somebody could look at 2020 and say, wow, that's really scary. That's what I think, because we didn't go over the precipice, but we almost did. And we have to realize that we could have gone over. But other people could look at it and say, oh, everything's going to be okay. I mean, that was nothing. You know, look at that. You know, it was actually a good year, but we were almost over. We could have gone over and we didn't go over, but we could have gone over. And so we should be reminded of that. So I'm agreeing with you. I think different people have taken both of those lessons, that either it scared the heck out of them and they're staying scared, and that's good because this stuff is risky. Or it's like, oh, you know, buy the dip. Don't worry about it, just buy the dip.
Yeah. Well, so Victor, for the listeners who, I feel like there's a cohort of listeners who are waiting patiently thinking, just tell me what to do with my money right now, Victor. So to me, it sounds like you're bullish, you know, would have a bullish allocation to stocks and perhaps even more so rest of the world versus US? Is that fair?
The first thing that the investor needs to do, I think, the investor needs to look in the mirror and really know himself or herself. You know, I think that the what you should do is really a function of your makeup and circumstances and everything. So what I would say is, if you look in the mirror and you see in the mirror somebody who's a long-term investor, somebody who's thinking about the long-term saving and investing for their retirement and for later in life, and you know, and somebody that is willing to be patient and disciplined and kind of boring in how they invest, if that's what you see when you look in the mirror, then I think, yes, owning a healthy fraction of equities for the long run probably makes sense for you, with if you have a typical amount of risk aversion, et cetera. I think that makes sense. But if you look in the mirror and you see somebody who's like, you know, who wants to make 20% a year and is like just reading everything to find out, you know, which coin they should invest in or which meme stock or whatever, and that's what your personality is, then don't do that. Because, well, I don't, you know, I would say try to change yourself. But if that's what you see in the mirror, you know, you're not going to be happy with this sort of boring long-term allocation to equities. The coin flip experiment, again, is really interesting in this regard, because what we found was that people would play it and they would do poorly on it. You know, very few people or not enough people made the $250 that everybody should have made. A sensible strategy of like betting 10% on each flip or 15% on each flip would have given you like a 98% chance of getting to $250 and walking out of that half hour at a very good, with a very good reward. But they didn't play it like that, and they didn't know, and they were under pressure, etc. So there's all these reasons, but they didn't play well. Then we talked about it afterwards. You know, we were in, it was like in a class, a lot of it was in a classroom or a meeting room or whatever. So we talked about it and we said, these are the reasons, this is how to think about it. These are the reasons why a constant proportional betting makes sense for most of the game. You know, you shouldn't bet on tails, obviously, all these different things. We talked about it. What we found was that if we let people play again, and some of the people did want to play it again, that they just all sat there and clicked away, you know, at 15% per hand, and just did that, got to the 250. We didn't pay them anymore, but they got the message, right? But the problem is that it's cool to sit there for a half an hour and just keep clicking at a 15% bet each time. But try doing that for 40 years. Try being disciplined and boring for 40 years and not saying, oh, the next one is going to be heads, I'm going to bet 30% on that. Or the next one's going to be tails, I'm going to bet on tails. I had my mom play the game for free, and I looked at her betting pattern and I said, Mom, you bet on tails. And she said, I knew I wasn't supposed to do that, but I just couldn't help myself. I just had to see what would happen. So it's really hard to be disciplined. It's even harder to be a journalist. And, you know, I think it was Jason Zweig has said, oh, it's really hard being a journalist and giving sound financial advice because it's so bloody boring. I mean, you just say the same thing.
Yeah. He says he's written the same column every year for
he's shown that you can do it. You know, you can, it is possible to be interesting and to keep going. But anyway, so that would be my advice for long-term investors. You know, have a healthy allocation to equities, own some tips, you know, as well. Don't, you know, I think the tips are less risky for us than treasury bills are. Even though the price of tips goes up and down, it is giving us a real consumption, you know, it's giving us something of a real hedge of consumption. Yeah, their yield is terrible right now, but you know, who knows? I mean, they could go down or up. It's a market. And, you know, I think that owning some tips is probably an okay thing too. And if tips get back to yielding a couple of percent above inflation, that would be great. You know, I think we'll all be happier then.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month,
like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4x points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Vildan, I think Victor's mom's strategy of betting on tails explains the entire cryptocurrency market. What do you think?
Well, I like, Victor, that you added in there that she played for free.
Yeah, actually, if my mom were playing for money, she probably wouldn't have bet on tails, I bet.
But we can't let you go. I want to ask you about, you know, the luck factor versus the skill factor in investing. And I know one of your more famous papers is titled What's Past Is Not Prologue, where you suggested that even if you look at two decades of performance, it's not enough to fully distinguish a fund manager from anything other than average. So can you talk about that? And can you talk about how you differentiate luck from skill in investing?
Sure. So, you know, there's we definitely are programmed behaviorally to extrapolate the future from a statistically insignificant amount of data. And, you know, there's all kinds of reasons that, you know, cognitive scientists say that we develop that way. So we did an experiment. We love doing these different experiments. And we did this experiment where we asked people, imagine you have two coins. Somebody is giving you two coins to flip. One of them has a 60% chance of landing on heads. The other one is a 50-50 coin. But we won't tell you which one it is, but you can flip them. If you want, you could flip them a million times, but tell us how many times do you need to flip them, sort of the minimum number of times that you need to flip them both, and count up how many times they've landed heads and tails, to have a 95% confidence that this is the coin that's 60-40, and that's the coin that is 50-50. And again, you know, like our readership are kind of quantitative financy people. You know, some of the people kind of gave the right answer, but we also asked people to just answer it based on their intuition and not to do the calculation. And a lot of people thought it took, you know, 10 flips, you know, with 10 flips you could tell, or 15 flips or 20 flips. Well, the answer is 143 flips, or maybe 141. I think 143 flips. I never would have guessed that. You know, if you had asked me, nobody guesses that. Just, you know, like 140. You have to do that thing 140 times to be that confident. I mean, I'm starting off 50-50. You know, like if I just choose that coin, I've got a 50% chance of choosing the right one, but I've got to do 140. So that's like an illustration, because if we're thinking about active managers versus the index, an index investment, that an active manager is going to be more like a 60-40 coin, you know, relative to the benchmark. But if he's not a good active manager, he's like just 50-50. You know, that he, if it's just a manager who's like just flipping, you know, who's just throwing darts at the wall, he'll be more like 50-50. In fact, he'll be worse, which I'll mention at the end. But let's just say he would be 50-50. And so what that tells you is you need a lot of data. You know, the world is not like coin flips. You know, that when you, by the time you get a lot of data on your manager, he's not even the manager anymore. It's somebody else. Or he's not, I mean,
right.
You know, that I'm not the same person that I'm going to be 10 years from now. You know, no man steps in the same river twice. So yeah, I think that was kind of the idea there, was to both show the statistical power of these things, you know, which is very weak, And also to show us our behavioral bias, you know, to extrapolate from too little data. But on top of that, you know, if we're just talking about active versus passive, I don't know if you've come across this Bessembinder. Hendrik Bessembinder is a academic professor from Arizona. And he's done this research where he looked at all U.S. equities. And even though, as we know, U.S. equities outperform treasury bills by like 6% a year over the last 120 years, he found that significantly more than half of all U.S. equities have underperformed treasury bills. What that tells you is that if you are if you are an active manager holding a concentrated portfolio of stocks, that a concentrated portfolio of stocks has a higher than 50% chance of underperforming an index because of that concentration itself. You know, it's like a volatility drag phenomenon. So when, you know, that somebody's got a concentrated portfolio that is riskier than the broad market, you know, if they were just throwing darts, you know, if they had no skill, there's more than a 50% chance before fees and before transactions costs that you would underperform the index because of this volatility drag. And then you've got fees and you've got taxes and you've got transactions costs, and the whole thing is a bit of a mess.
I don't know, Vildad, all this talk about coin flips has me interested in the biggest prop bet of the Super Bowl at all. You can bet on the coin flip at the opening of the Super Bowl. So you might want to get in on that. Put 20 on heads.
Which I think has become popular thanks to what happened to the Buffalo Bills.
What happened? Refresh my memory to happen to them?
No, don't do it. Don't go there.
Sorry.
Tighten up your straitjackets. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Well, speaking of knowing something, Vildana, I think it's that time to know what your craziest thing you saw in markets was this week. Let's hear it. I think I have an idea what it's going to be.
Really good transition.
Yeah, thanks.
I think you might not know. But first, I had a submission come into my Twitter, which, by the way, I noticed nobody ever sends you submissions. They send them to me.
I get some. I always forget about them, though. I do.
Anyway, this one is from, and I really hope I pronounce this correctly. I even asked him how to pronounce it, but his name is Brian Reichhoff. And he sent a message that said, fixed income feels a bit boomer compared to crypto, but it's wild. And he shared a tweet, which actually was from last week, but somebody pointed out that equity investors, especially in the U.S., could be forgiven for thinking that the most important events of the last 48 hours were Facebook and Amazon numbers. Wrong. It was the Six Sigma move in European rates. The bond boogeyman is coming to an equity market near you. So I wanted to share that one, even though it was from last week, and just remind everybody that if anyone sees anything weird, you can send it to my Twitter. Not Mike's, mine.
Yeah, it's a good point, Victor, about this, the velocity of the move in rates. I feel like that is makes you have to rethink your allocations a bit more frequently than you would otherwise, or what? Does the that sort of rate of change in yields that we've seen give you any, you know, give you the spins at all? Does it make you, you know, want to reallocate more than perhaps you would otherwise?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, keeping an eye on your portfolio once a month or once a quarter is not bad. I mean, you know, I think that if we move sort of in a straight line, let's take U.S. tips for an example. So 10-year tips were trading at like minus 1% around the end of 2021. And now I think maybe we're around -0.5%. Yeah, I mean, I think that if tips went from minus 1%, you know, all the way up to 2% over a couple of months, you know, it would be a shame to have missed out on the opportunity, perhaps, to have reduced your equity allocation as that was happening, assuming that equities did not fall as much as would have been called for by that increase in real yields. You know, you're right that the velocity of changes in everything, I mean, everything has sort of got this. I mean, the markets, you know, I don't know, over time have sort of developed into this, not much is going on, and then boom, you know, they make these big moves. And, you know, that they've become much more, in my feeling, you know, they're much more discontinuous than they used to be, which I think might have to do with there just being much less market maker capital relative to the size of the market than there used to be. But I don't know. Not sure about that.
Less of a shock absorber built into the system, I guess.
I think there's less shock absorber from that. I'm not that worried. You know, I think that, you know, that in other, I guess the reason I'm not that concerned about it is that when interest rates go up, if equities don't move at all, we'll want to reduce our equity allocation. But, you know, when interest rates go up, equities are going to go down somewhat. And when you look at the whole thing, you're going to want to reduce, you know, maybe you were at 70% in equities and you might want to reduce down to 64% in equities or something. It's not, you know, that looking at it, even if you're looking at it every quarter, for our business and for the clients, you know, that where we're managing capital, we're rebalancing their portfolio every week. We also have a risk indicator in the form of momentum that we're using to underweight or overweight in conjunction with excess earnings yield. So, you know, we're trying to stay on top of all of that. But for individual investors who are self-managing, you know, these long-term investors that are looking in the mirror and seeing themselves as long-term investors, it's okay to you know, I think that you're okay doing this stuff. Looking at your portfolio once a quarter is fine, I think.
All right, Victor, how about you? You see anything crazy in markets this week?
Well, that was a good one that wrote into Vildana. You know, the thing that just amazes me is what's going on in the options market in the U.S. Options trading in single stocks now is as big as trading in the stocks themselves. So we always thought of options as the derivatives, you know, but at these kind of volumes, you're wondering which is the real and which is the derivative. So we're getting, I don't know, $400-500 billion of options are trading every day. And that's about the same amount as is trading in the stock market in individual names. Even more remarkable than that is like 1/3 of all of the options trading is in Tesla.
That's amazing.
And then amazing beyond that is like 80% of that trading is in options expiring out to 1 month. So, you know, it's really, I think there's no doubt that the securities markets are also functioning as an outlet for the same kinds of demand that take people to Vegas or AC. You know, yeah. That there is a gambling, there is this sort of almost, you know, risk-seeking kind of behavior that we're seeing manifest itself in the securities markets, in the coin markets. You know, I think it's, I mean, you know, look, Americans are spending, I don't know, $80 billion a year on lottery tickets. And I haven't bought any. I bet Vildana, have you bought any lottery tickets recently? Right?
So I have not.
So like $80 billion a year on lottery tickets. I think that's, I'm not sure, but let's call that $250 per person. But the three of us haven't even bought any. So there's some people out there that are spending thousands of dollars a year on lottery tickets. Now, you know, these are just, you know, mysteries, you know, that academic finance has not really explained this. These are mysteries, but they're also kind of, I think that they're also problems. You know, I think that we would have less inequality. I think we would have more wealth, you know, general welfare of everybody. You know, I mean, it's kind of remarkable to me. And, you know, that $70 or $80 billion pales in comparison to people buying and selling 1 week out of the money Tesla options.
Yeah, the YOLO effect.
Yeah, it's like what crazy happened recently? It's like what's happening that's not crazy?
Yeah, I know. It's gotten tougher to find. We'll have to change it to the most rational thing I saw this week. But it's an excellent point, and I think we're all trying to wrap our heads around sort of the tail wagging the dog effect of it all. When you have, you know, everyone talking about gamma hedging as being the main driver of a market on any given week, it's strange times indeed. All right, I'll give you my crazy thing. I'm going to take you both out of your comfort zones, though, and get into the private markets a little bit. And as you know, the term unicorn refers to a private startup company that gets a valuation of $1 billion or more in private markets before they go public. Business Week had a story talking about the whole unicorn phenomenon. And, you know, the reason they're called unicorn is because that at one point was considered such a rarity to have a private company get that sort of valuation, you know, a startup to get that sort of valuation before going public. So this Business Week story lists, gives a count, a number of the total number of unicorns out there currently. And Vildana, you'd be smirking had you read this story. Usually you've read the story I'm referring, and I can tell you
I have read it. I am smirking.
You have read? Oh, okay. So you know the answer. All right. Well, let's see if we'll quiz Victor. Victor, how many unicorns do you think there are out there in the world today?
Sorry, is it, did you say it's private or? Yeah, private. Private?
Yeah, private. Private companies, I think embedded in the definition is the notion that they're sort of a startup, somewhat new. You know, you wouldn't consider, say, a private company that's been around 100 years, but a startup that's a few years old, that's worth at least $1 billion. How many do you think?
I'm going to embarrass myself. 27.
27.
Wow. Can I give the answer?
Yes.
It's 1,000.
1,000. I know. I couldn't believe it.
The best quote from this article is somebody said, when you have 1,000 unicorns, that's almost an oxymoron. It is. I love that.
That's incredible.
A $1 trillion in unicorns. It's unbelievable. Wow. But it seems to me that, like, suggests there's some sort of lopsidedness between the private and public markets that needs to resolve itself. I don't know. It just seems like I don't know why, but there's so much money sloshing around in those markets. People think they have an edge, I guess. I don't know. I don't get it.
I'm certainly out of touch. Elm is not investing in the private markets. That's part of it.
I couldn't believe it either. That's why I brought it up. I never would have guessed that many. I would have maybe said, 27 sounds about right. But a couple hundred tops, but 1,000 unicorns. Pretty amazing. Anyway, Victor, fascinating conversation. Really appreciate your time. And I hope we can get you back next time you've got some hot off the press research, even though this research isn't even on the press yet. I think it's pre-press, hot off the typewriter, I guess.
Yeah, we'll get it up onto SSRN and on our website soon. But you heard it here first.
You heard it here first. And I encourage everyone to go play Victor's coin flip game. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys. It was really a pleasure being on. Thank you very much for having me.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website or app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Ring Anonymous. Vildana Heyrich is at Vildana Heyrich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio. What Goes Up is produced by Laura Carlson. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.